This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Over the weekend, the New York Times and the Washington Post reported that military intelligence and the CIA gather private financial information about Americans and foreigners with suspected links to terrorism. The agencies ask for and receive the information from American credit card companies and banks. On Monday, a story in the Los Angeles Times said the Internal Revenue Service provides information to intelligence agencies for much the same reasons. Normally, domestic counterterrorism investigations inside America's borders are handled by the FBI. Civil liberties advocates worry that the Pentagon and the CIA's actions are unnecessary and illegal intrusions into the lives of Americans. Government lawyers argue that it's perfectly legal and that follow the money is just as important when you investigate terrorists as it was to investigate Watergate. Later in the program, political junkie Ken Rudin watches to see whose toe is exactly how deep in presidential waters, and we'll consider a crazy idea. What about a fusion ticket? McCain-Clinton, Obama-Hagel. If you have thoughts or questions about electoral politics, you can email the political junkie now. The address is talk@npr.org. But first, national security, financing terror, and you. If you have questions about what U.S. intelligence agencies are doing, whether it works or whether it's legal, give us a call. We'd also like to hear from banks and credit card companies. Would your company voluntarily provide private financial information to the federal government? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Joining us here in Studio 3A is Eric Lichtblau. He reports on U.S. intelligence for the New York Times. And Eric, always nice to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me. Nick.
And as important and as interesting as those stories are, and we'll get to them in a moment, another story has just crossed the wires within the last half hour, where this involves what the White House calls the terrorist surveillance program and what critics call the domestic espionage, the wiretaps conducted by the National Security Agency without warrants. And news today, the Justice Department has just announced that in the future, these will be handled by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. And this is, to begin with, Eric, I'm going to ask you to explain a couple of things, but one of the things it is a white flag going up from the administration.
Well, I think that the administration is essentially pulling the plug on the program, at least as it's existed for the last 5 years now. What the Attorney General said in a letter that was just released a few minutes ago to the ranking members of the Judiciary Committee was that they would agree to put this warrantless surveillance program under the court, the secret court that it's been arguing does not have jurisdiction over this. So they've agreed, on the one hand, to say that the court can rule on this and can have judicial oversight, while at the same time maintaining that they had the legal authority to do what they have been doing for the last 5 years.
Part of the letter from the Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez, says that these orders are innovative, they're complex, it took considerable time and work for the government to develop the approach that was proposed to the court and for the judge on FISC, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, to consider and approve those orders. And all of that may be true. Also intervening in the process was an election where Republicans lost control in the United States Senate and the House of Representatives.
Sure, there was a lot of political pressure on the White House over a range of counterterrorism programs. The Democrats, now that they're in control, were promising to mount aggressive oversight, particularly the NSA program, but other programs as well.
And we're going to have to await details. There are briefings scheduled here in Washington later today to inform reporters as to exactly what's going to be required under these new orders. In other words, one of the complaints the government had last time about using the FISA court to enforce these wiretaps was that it was not quick or agile enough. So one of the questions, obviously, is the government going to have to go to the FISA court to get a warrant every single time it wants to wiretap somebody who's one half of the conversation in this country and half abroad.
Right. What they appear to be describing from the Attorney General's letter is the FISA court having given them broader authority, program authority, to monitor international communications in a similar to a way that they've been doing now, but at least with some judicial oversight, which has been lacking before this. And interestingly, in the very last line of the letter, it says that the president will no longer authorize the warrantless wiretap program. He's had to approve that, sign a secret order every 45 days for most of the last 5 years. They say that once that 45-day term runs out this time, he will not reauthorize it, which is critical.
So stay tuned to NPR News for further developments on this story as they happen and further explanation of what's exactly involved. But Eric Lichtblau, getting back to the story we asked you to come in for, we thank you for that.
Sure.
But in terms of the Pentagon and the Central Intelligence Agency gathering domestic intelligence, aren't they prohibited from doing that?
Well, they're certainly restricted. Whether or not there's an out-and-out ban is a subject of some debate. Traditionally, the Pentagon and the CIA have a very limited role in domestic intelligence gathering. They're not supposed to engage in traditional law enforcement. That's supposed to be the domain of the FBI. They are not supposed to engage in anything that might tread on the political or First Amendment rights of Americans. They do have interests, for instance, at the Pentagon in protecting military bases. Now, that's a mandate which some people believe has been defined fairly broadly by the Pentagon since 9/11, in the interest of force protection, looking into areas within the United States that they really didn't go into before. Mm-hmm. Similarly with the CIA, they have a restricted interest in internal security within the United States as it relates to CIA employees. That's a definition that they, again, seem to be employing more broadly. And what we've seen with the story that we published Sunday was that they have been, the Pentagon in particular, has been aggressive in seeking records from financial companies about people within the United States, both military and civilian, that they think may represent either a terrorist threat or an espionage threat.
And how are they gathering this intelligence?
These are through what are known as national security letters. Now, we've known for several years that the FBI has been issuing these letters. These are known in shorthand as NSLs, very aggressively, issuing thousands of these. And there's been quite a pushback for the FBI over their use of these letters to get telephone logs, financial records, a range of other material.
And they are roughly equivalent to subpoenas?
Yes and no. There are differences. One of the key differences is that for a long time, the recipient was not even allowed to tell anyone they had received such a letter. And there was
even their own lawyer.
There was debate about whether or not you could even get a lawyer. So people that have been targeted with these letters and civil liberties groups have now challenged them successfully in court to say that these are represent undue search and seizure. Now, it was not known before our story that the Pentagon and the CIA were also using these same letters domestically. So what we discussed in our story was that the Pentagon has been issuing hundreds of these letters over the last 5 years in terrorism and espionage cases to get financial records. They are, unlike the FBI's, they are not considered mandatory. They are requests. But when a military intelligence officer shows up at the bank's door, we are told they are almost always turned over.
And it's the voluntary aspect of it can be colored by circumstances.
Yes.
How widespread is this?
As we were told, it's become standard practice for the Pentagon to issue these letters in any open investigation where they believe there may be suspicions of either terrorism or espionage within the United States. So it's become a standard investigative technique, what they considered a less intrusive means of gathering evidence. Now, the military acknowledges that most of the time these leads wash out. They consider them valuable, more often than not, in disproving suspicions and showing that a military contractor or a translator, for instance, is not in fact a spy or a terrorist, that his unexplained wealth, why he was driving a Porsche, there are other reasons to explain that other than perhaps getting money from bad guys.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, we only saw a couple of examples provided that give us any idea of what they're actually looking at.
Yeah, we were able to get a few examples. One was a fairly well-known case involving a chaplain down at Guantanamo, chaplain Daniel Yee, who was accused of aiding terrorism suspects at Guantanamo. Now, those charges were ultimately dropped, but what we were told was that these letters were used to gather financial records about Yee. There are other cases we've been told about involving translators, civilian contractors, questions of unexplained wealth. We're not aware, so far at least, of any cases where the gathering of those records has actually led to charges that were sustained against anyone regarding terrorism or espionage.
And even if, in the case of somebody like Mr. Yee, who was cleared of
right.
Apparently the Pentagon wants to hold on to this information.
Yes. What we reported was that this will become part of a database at the Counterintelligence Field Activity Office that will use the records on a limited basis to allow investigators to look for patterns and trails of information on financial records.
Mm-hmm.
The military sees this as having great intelligence value, that something that may not appear terribly interesting or helpful right now, a year from now, might paint a picture of some broader pattern. The counter-argument from the civil liberties advocates is that this is yet another database of tips that have led nowhere, and the organization, the CIFA group that will maintain the database, has gotten into some hot water already for maintaining a separate database that was including information on hundreds of anti-war protesters, people who were staging rallies outside military bases to protest the war in Iraq.
And as frightening as some people will find the idea of the Pentagon and the Central Intelligence Agency gathering domestic intelligence information, the idea that the IRS is providing it to them, that's very scary to a lot of people.
Right. This is all, you know, part of a broader pattern of the government after 9/11 getting access, legitimately or not, to a wide range of material that was either off limits before 9/11 or in a gray area. What the Social Security Administration and the IRS did after 9/11 was to approve ad hoc emergency orders, giving investigators, usually FBI investigators, access to Social Security numbers, IRS tax information, things like that, as part of terrorism investigations. So there was an effort to, a conscious effort to knock down walls that had separated different agencies before 9/11.
Mm-hmm. And part of that was also using the information provided by the Internal Revenue Service and subjecting it to data mining, looking for patterns across any number of things. In other words, zoning in on one individual return is not going to provide necessarily the information they're looking for, but looking for it as part of a pattern might.
There certainly seems to be some of that going on. It's unclear exactly how this information has been used, whether or not it has been mined in that broad way that you're talking about. It was certainly used for specific investigations with specific targets. The broader data mining is more controversial and less clear exactly what is happening.
Eric Lischblau, stay with us. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking about the legality and wisdom of these operations of domestic intelligence gathering that he's been describing for us. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about who's looking at your bank account. The New York Times reported over the weekend that the CIA and the military collect personal information on Americans and on foreigners living in this country with suspected ties to terrorism. Domestic surveillance, of course, is usually the domain of the FBI. Our guest is Eric Lischblau, who reports on intelligence for the New York Times and one of the authors of that story. If you have questions about what U.S. intelligence agencies are doing, whether it works, whether it's legal, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And joining us now are two men with varying views on the wisdom and legality of these operations. Joining us now is Robert Turner, co-founder and associate director of the Center for National Security Law at the University of Virginia. He joins us by phone from his office in Charlottesville. Nice to have you on the program.
Good to be back, Neil.
And also with us is Jonathan Weiner, a partner at the firm Alston & Byrd. I suppose it's Alston & Byrd, if you wanted to pronounce it correctly. He's a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for International Law Enforcement back during the Clinton administration. He's been kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. Thanks for coming in.
Happy to be here.
And Robert Turner, let me turn to you. Is this legal? Is it wise?
I think it's clearly legal, and I think it's clearly wise. Now, if there's evidence of abuse, a lot of very useful powers in government can be abused. The president in wartime has authority to order bombs to be dropped and people to be killed without any involvement of a judge or whatever. And if the president were to order the military to bomb Ted Kennedy's home or something like that, obviously we would want to investigate that abuse and punish all those involved. I haven't heard that. What I've heard is they're trying to track down terrorists who want to kill Americans by following the money. I'm reminded of the remarks by Lee Hamilton, who co-chaired the 911 Commission, who said that following the money was, quote, a particularly powerful tool in the fight against terrorist groups and a critical part of the overall campaign against Al-Qaeda. Well, that's what we're doing here. We're talking about, if you have someone you have of a reason to believe might be a terrorist, you check out their financial records. If you find they've got large deposits being transferred in from overseas, then you look further at them. You don't put them in jail for that. You use that as a tool. If you find that they're clean, for example, if somebody has bought a new convertible or new Jaguar or BMW or something, you find he's made some outside income from writing a book or something like that, mm-hmm. then you stop looking at him and you focus on others. And that by itself is critically important in trying to find the people who are trying to kill us.
All right. Jonathan Weiner, is it legal? Is it wise?
We don't know enough about it yet to know whether it's legal or not legal. It's certainly an authority that the Congress refused to give the military and the CIA as a mandatory matter. It's not an authority that people understood was going to be used for this purpose. Whether it's wise, we still need more information as well. I've always thought that it was probably sufficient for the FBI to be doing counterterrorism investigations in the United States and for the FBI to be using these authorities to try and make criminal cases. It was always my position when I was in the Clinton administration thinking that the CIA and the Pentagon were best looking at foreign threats overseas. I'm a strong supporter of going after databases and bank records against various kinds of threats, criminal threats, drug trafficking threats, proliferation threats, as well as terrorist threats. The question is, who should be doing it? Is this something a Treasury enforcement agency should be doing and the FBI, or is this something that the CIA and Pentagon should be doing as well? We know there are rules and procedures and processes which govern the first stuff. You know, the FBI has been doing this kind of thing for a long time, and there's judicial oversight. We don't know what rules and processes govern what the agency is doing here and what the Pentagon is doing here. I think this is something that the Congress is going to need to investigate and find out to determine whether it was wise.
Mm. Let's get some callers on the line, and we'll begin with Sarah. Sarah calling us from Toledo, Ohio.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a quick question. I teach statistics and computer databases at a university, and I'm constantly educating my students that out in the business world, there are mega marketing companies that are already obtaining and buying very specific financial information on consumers out in the industry every day and conducting some serious data mining for products and services. And I'm wondering what the difference is and why there is so much hesitancy when we know that businesses have been doing this for decades and that Congress has allowed it and has not really looked into any rules or regulations as to how it's handled, what's done with the information once it's been data mined. I'm seeing a dichotomy here, and I'm trying to understand.
Well, let's ask somebody about it. Eric Lischblau, did this come up as you did your report?
Well, I think the caller is right in saying that the whole terrain of data mining is still a murky one, that it's often unclear what is and is not allowed, and there's not a whole lot in the way of set rules and regulations. The difference between the private sector data mining and the government is the power of the government to investigate individuals, to use investigative tools, subpoenas, you know, even imprisonment, if they believe that. I mean, there's a difference between culling information and somehow using it for an investigative purpose with the power of the government behind you.
But she's also right that a lot of personal private information, which you think is personal and private, is available commercially anywhere around the country.
Sure, absolutely. Another difference, though, is that there are specific restrictions on what the CIA and the Pentagon can do because of potential abuses that are not necessarily clear when it comes to private sector's use of data.
And Jonathan Weiner, it's fair to point out that there have been abuses in the past.
Sure. Going on the private sector for a moment, Congress passed a law back in the Financial Modernization Act 5 or 6 years ago, which basically strengthened the privacy rights of people to their financial records and data. And financial institutions are not allowed to share data except with the permission of the account holder, except for very, very narrow purposes, basically to carry out what they wanted. So there are all kinds of controls and restrictions on the use of data. That doesn't mean people don't abuse it, but there are laws in place that control it.
Robert Turner, if it's available commercially, should it be available to the government?
Yeah, I think Sarah asked a great question. As a consumer, I'm concerned about private groups gathering all sorts of information about me and selling it, although most of mine I think would be pretty boring. But the idea that we allow that to happen but don't want the people who are trying to protect us against terrorist attacks to have similar access is silly, but we've got five statutes, including the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 77 and the Right to Financial Privacy Act of 78, that expressly authorize the issuance of national security letters or other administrative subpoenas for these national security purposes. In the HIPAA Act, the president has to declare a national emergency before these subpoenas can be issued, or these national security letters. But in this case, Congress has passed the equivalent to a declaration of war. They have passed a joint resolution, a statute, declaring that we can use force against our enemy, you know, Al-Qaeda and its allies, And what we're trying to do in that process is also find out where they're keeping their money and try to identify some of them, because in this business of terrorism, large amounts of money have to change hands. And mm-hmm. if we can find, most of what we're looking at are international transactions, as I understand it. And this has been, there's been public testimony about this before Congress. It's been reported to the committees. This just is not the the scandals of the Church Pike Commission back in or committees back in the mid 70s. I worked in the Senate then and sat through those, and there were some abuses. But right now we have so many checks on this. We've got private sector checks. We've got executive branch checks. We've got Congress looking over the shoulder. For NSA, for example, today there are 100 people in the Inspector General's office watching, and if any of them sees any hint that George Bush is trying to focus his attention on Ted Kennedy or John Kerry or Hillary Clinton, you can bet it's going to be in the New York Times by morning, and then we can investigate that. But when what they're doing is just go, you know, really trying to go after terrorists, go after people, you know, I heard it was Eric say that the military should focus on armed threats overseas. I wondered if he slept through 9/11. Those armed threats have come into this country, and they plan on killing people here, and they plan on attacking our military.
Are you suggesting that the you know, the investigation, once those 21 people were 19 people were in American territory, that the investigation should have been handled by the CIA?
I don't think so. No, I mean, but
or the military?
The CIA does this very seldom. We're talking about a very small number of cases. I'll give you one example of where the CIA should have had this power and didn't back in 1993. And that is the Aldrich Ames case. I don't know if you, how much, I'm sure you remember that case.
Sure.
But, you know, I've spent hours with some of the counterintelligence people at CIA who actually broke this case, and they struggled to try to find out who was doing it. And Ames kept showing up. Ames was wearing expensive suits and driving a Jaguar and had a, you know, a $400,000, $500,000 home. And they checked, and he took out a loan from the credit union for the car. He had just married a Colombian woman whose family was very wealthy, and the mother-in-law provided a certificate saying that she had provided the money for the house. Finally, they were able to get enough evidence to get a warrant and look at his records, and within minutes, they broke the case because they found that he was allowed as part of his job to meet with a Soviet embassy official mm-hmm. at regular occasions. And they found that 1 or 2 days after each of these meetings, he was depositing $20,000 or $30,000 in cash in his bank account. And
well,
you know, all the alarms went off and they broke that case. But in the years that the privacy laws kept them from looking at that, 5 or 6 American spies in the Soviet Union were tortured and murdered because Ames continued to function. And at some point, we've got to draw a balance. I very much believe in privacy rights, but when we are talking about trying to prevent the next 9/11, which might dwarf the first one because it might involve, you know, WMDs, anthrax, or smallpox, all sorts of things, you know, we have to give the government the tools to protect us. We have to have some oversight. There is all sorts of internal oversight. If there are allegations of abuse, let us focus on those. But for God's sake, let's not leak every technique we have to the enemy, because if we do, you know, if
I hear what you're saying. I just wanted to thanks.
Sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
Yes, get Sarah back on the line. Yes, go ahead.
I just have one more comment. Again, I was mentioning that I teach this information, and one of your gentlemen mentioned that there are a whole plethora of checks and balances in the business or commercial sale of financial data. And in fact, there is very little as far as individuals in terms of recourse for incorrect financial data as it's sold or however it's used.
Yeah, I see Jonathan Weiner shaking his head, which suggests that there is recourse, but as a practical matter, what you're saying is that there isn't.
Let me shake your head,
it's by phone, Neil.
And
a
just
small amount of individual recourse related to your financial records. It really sounds like the government involvement in view of financial data is much more comprehensive than what you find in the business sector.
All right. Let me just clarify.
Could you do it very quickly, please?
Yeah, she picked up on what I'm talking about is there's something called the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications, or SWIFT, and that's the primary group that we work with in this process, and it has its own internal oversight of the process. So if they felt something fishy were going on, they could then raise it with Congress or make it public or something like that. I didn't mean to be saying that when these private groups are out there doing this, on their own they're checked. I don't think they are checked.
Okay.
I think it's a serious concern.
Robert Turner is co-founder and associate director for the Center of National Security Law at the University of Virginia. Also with us, Jonathan Weiner, a partner at the law firm of Alston and Byrd, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for International Law Enforcement during the Clinton administration, and Eric Lischblau, who covers intelligence matters for the New York Times. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line, and this is William. William in California.
Yes, thank you so much.
Sure.
I'm so glad you're having this topic. At the outset, there seemed to be a difference between your understanding and the first guest's understanding of the voluntary nature of this. Both you and the guest said that the interference with the voluntary nature of releasing this by the bank was that a military officer would show up and that would be somehow an influence. On the other hand, I listened very carefully to what the vice president said. I've listened to it several times.
Mr. Cheney was on Fox News on Sunday, yeah.
He said it's voluntary letters, but he said that if a bank objects, they can go to court to resist it.
What's voluntary in this context, Jonathan Weiner?
Well, let's say that I'm advising a big financial institution that's just gotten a request from the CIA to provide information about an alleged terrorist threat. And the bank says, you know, we really don't think this is mandatory. We'd rather not do it. It makes us uncomfortable. What will happen if we go to court, John? Will you be able to keep all this suppressed so nobody finds out that we're fighting the government on this? I'm going to say, of course I can't do that. It's going to be an open court. You'll have the media attention. Everybody else will be paying attention to this, most likely. Don't know that you'll be able to keep it secret.
But what is
and at that point, they're going to say, well, that could be a huge public relations problem for us if we're not cooperating with the United States government on terrorism. Why don't we just do it?
Mm-hmm. I think it's important to point out that this question
of whether
or not you could contest these letters was controversial, even in the context of the FBI serving these letters. We've known for years, as I said, that the mm-hmm. FBI was making these records demands, and it was only clarified in the law by Congress last year that you had a clear right to judicial review, that you had a clear right to contact a defense lawyer if you were served with one of these letters. Now, with the area of the CIA and the Pentagon serving these letters, you're into even grayer, even murkier territory because no one knew that they were using these letters.
Mm-hmm.
Could I say something else?
Go ahead, please. Go ahead.
The implication of saying they're voluntary letters means you can give them or not. When he says you can only not give them if you go to court, there's nothing the least bit voluntary about the request, in my opinion.
Robert Turner?
Yeah, my understanding is they don't have to comply with most of these. The one exception where they can compel is access to basically credit rating information, the same kind of stuff that any used car dealer in America can have access to, which, you know, again, I don't view that as I'd much rather have it be have my credit rating data be looked at by the government to exclude me as a possible terrorist than by some guy who wants to send me a credit card I don't want. So, my understanding is that the other letters being issued by the Pentagon and the CIA are voluntary. They request the information, and if you say no, perhaps then it goes to court. I'm not certain exactly how that works, mm-hmm. but I have seen reports saying that it's voluntary,
which may
well be their initiative is to go to court on it. I'm not certain of that.
Jonathan Weiner?
As we try to understand this, it's important, I think, to distinguish between two things. The first is, should government be going after people's financial records in pursuit of terrorism cases? And there I think the answer is yes. Absolutely, it's an important part of following money trails is essential. The next question is, should there be a rule of law, legal processes to cover it? And in relationship to that, should this be done by domestic law enforcement agencies or by foreign intelligence and national security agencies? It seems to me that it's a very good idea for the Pentagon and CIA to be going to Bosnia and looking through computer disks in Bosnia of terrorist groups to determine if they're going to be money trails. It's important that they do it in Iraq. It's important that they do it in Afghanistan. I'm not so sure they're the right people to be doing it in Manhattan, and that's the question that we need to understand. If it's a defense contractor, that sounds like a criminal investigation. It doesn't sound like a terrorist investigation. If it's a military chaplain, that sounds like it's something that requires an internal review for DOD. There may be DOD processes and procedures there. But again, if you're getting into bank records, it sounds like the kind of province of a domestic law enforcement agency like the FBI, which looks at domestic terrorist threats.
Neil?
And very quickly.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent summary of the issue, and I think we need to distinguish one step further. That is, I think it is a good idea to be going after financial records.
And very quickly.
But we ought to distinguish between law investigations motivated by law enforcement purposes and investigations motivated by counterterrorism purposes, and it's in those, even though they may ultimately
and
be
very
law
quickly.
Enforcement, sorry, that I think this is a good process.
Robert Turner, thank you very much for your time. Also,
my
our
pleasure.
Thanks to Jonathan Weiner, who was with us here in Studio 3A, along with Eric Lischblau of The New York Times.
Thanks
and
for having me.
Again, we'll continue to follow that other story. Thank you, William, for your call, by the way. And we're going to continue to follow that other story about the Terrorist Surveillance Act and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Courts. This is NPR News.